This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
What happens to people who live abroad in times of war? The following is a recording of a special event launching a new exhibition at the GHIL on internment during the First World War, the Global German Experience. During the First World War, German civilians were interned as enemy aliens in British Empire locations across the world. The biggest internment camp was Nokelo on the Isle of Man, holding 22,000 prisoners. British citizens, white and non-white, were interned in Ruhleben camp near Berlin as a retaliatory measure, bringing the global experience of internment back to the German home front. For civilian internees across the world, long periods of isolation caused mental health problems in the form of the barbed wire disease. Humanitarian support came from the Spanish and the Swiss governments, as well as the Red Cross. The exhibition at the GHIL focuses on these global themes, opening up new perspectives and formats for presenting the history of wartime internment. Alongside 18 panels, a virtual reality experience will give viewers an immersive experience of Fort Napier Camp in South Africa. The following symposium features talks from six experts in the field: Panikos Panayi, Michelle Kiesling, Matthew Stibbe, Susan Barton, Stefan Manz, and Paul Long.
So the reason I'm putting these pictures up is the origins of this exhibition, which is that I've worked on internment for many years, and so has Stefan. So it all began, I guess, with this book on the top left, The Enemy in Our Midst. And then Stefan did a more concentrated study. And then we did our own things. And then eventually, while we initially worked on internment in Great Britain, I guess the imperial turn took over and we realized how everything worked upon an imperial basis. And we eventually ended up with this book on the my bottom right. And so if we move on to the second slide, and I think what during the course of our research, we obviously realized that the German diaspora is global, you know, work that Klaus Bader had done, for example, over many decades, and people had already established at the end of the 19th century. And what we also realized was that incarceration didn't just take place on a British level, but also on the global level, because I guess when you're thinking, I mean, the imperial turn has taken over everything, but when you're thinking about the early 20th century, you have to think imperially. So the British always thought imperially from whenever the empire was established. And so when it came to the First World War, incarceration of Germans took place on an imperial global level. And so the conclusions that we increasingly came to while we were writing the book was that five hubs of internment emerged. So it will become clearer also in the next slide. So the first hub is Canada, the second hub, or Canada stroke the Western Hemisphere, and this will all become clear in a minute. The second hub is basically Great Britain. The third hub would be South Africa. The fourth hub would be India, and then the fifth hub would be Australasia, if we can use that phrase to also incorporate New Zealand, so Australia, New Zealand. So how did these hubs emerge? So what we did is, when we were writing the book, we looked at early camps. So basically, when the British Empire starts interning, it's in a fairly haphazard way, and so camps appear everywhere. And then there's a sort of turning point in the spring, late spring of 1915, where a decision is made for consolidation to take place. So this is where the hubs come into operation. So this first hub doesn't just incorporate the Germans who are resident in Canada, but also, I guess, the other background we have to think about is British naval power. which is still, you know, very dominant at the beginning of the 20th century, is in operation. So the Canadian hub, both in turns, the Germans in Canada, but also, as this arrow shows you, it brings the Germans who were in the Caribbean and Atlantic islands as well. And then the other thing, because of the power of the British Navy, and I guess this was one of the things that I've found most shocking, stroke traumatic, well, for the people involved, is that you could be sailing across the Atlantic Ocean, a British steamer comes along, takes you to, you know, the nearest port, and then for the next 4 years, you're, well, in an internment camp. So people could be taken off a ship in the Atlantic, taken to Britain, usually, or Canada. So that's our first hub, Canada. Our second hub is Great Britain. And as you can see, anyone, so it's the British, sorry, the Germans in Britain are held there, and then people are brought from all sorts of places. So we've simplified it here. So West Africa, the Germans in West Africa are brought here. But again, I came across examples of people sailing in the Pacific who ended up in camps on the Isle of Man. And then in Africa, there's a consolidation in South Africa, which will become clear in a minute. And then the fourth hub, as I mentioned, is India. So that's not just the Germans in India, but the Germans in East Africa, the Germans in Siam. So the Siamese government didn't know what to do with its Germans, and the British were the experts in incarceration, so it outsourced its incarceration to the British, who sent their Germans to camps in India. And then finally, we didn't do Australia in a great deal of detail, because that's been done by other people, especially Gerhard Fischer. And it sucks up Pacific Germans, but it also even brings Germans from Ceylon and not to the Indian camps, and as far afield as Hong Kong, as you can see. So the way we wrote our book was, so we had a general first section about incarceration in the British Empire and how it operated, and then we honed in two ways. First of all, on a national level, and secondly, on a camp level. So the three case studies we decided to do were Great Britain, India, and South Africa. So these are the camps that existed in Great Britain and India. So the head camp in Britain, and actually in the whole of the British Empire, is Knockalo on the Isle of Man. And so that's begun to become memorialized in the last 5 to 10 years. And I think Matthew and Stefan and I have, you know, been involved in that. And the head camp in India was Ahmednagar. So Ahmednagar just sucks in people from East Africa, some of the Siamese Germans, and all sorts of Germans who lived in India. So the people in Ahmednagar are especially elites. So, you know, there's different ways of thinking about German migration. You know, it's a proletarian migration, for want of a better word, and also very much an elite migration. And then in South Africa, the camp we focused on, and I think this is where the virtual reality thing will focus on, is Fort Napier. So that was the head camp in South Africa. And if we were to do the same for Australia, it will be Holsworthy, which is just outside Sydney. So, you know, we operated at three levels when we were writing our book. One was the conceptual or general approach, second was the national, and then on the individual camps. So when we were tackling the individual camps, what we were focusing on was everyday life, I guess, for want of a better phrase. So these are just three pictures which illustrate that life went on. So I think Matthew later is going to talk about the mental issues that arose. So this is more about everyday life. So just these three pictures on the top. Well, my top left, as I'm looking at it, we have allotments in Knockalo. Bottom left is Christmas in Fort Napier. And Christmas is incredibly important as a German festival by this period. And it's especially important in the internment camps. Although, you know, a lot of the Germans who are interned resent this because they really want to be with their families. And so some narratives I read really didn't want to get up on Christmas morning, but then in the end they did, because I guess they knew they had to. And then theatre is really important. There's research being done on that since the time itself. So theatre is especially important because it allows all sorts of groups to come together, whether as actors, as audience, as technicians, And, you know, it creates a sort of mental unity, a positive mental unity within the camp. So I think I've had my 9 minutes. So thank you very much for listening.
So I want to continue this story by thinking about the way in which internment came back to that German home front in 1914 as well. It's not just Germans across the world, but Germans on the home front were soon very much aware through newspaper reporting about the global extent of internment of Germans across the world, and pressure developed for some kind of retaliation. And the retaliation took the form of the creation of a camp near Berlin at Ruhleben. If any of you know Berlin, it's the end station on the U2 underground line. It's the west of Berlin. But this is where British and colonial British civilians were interned as a retaliatory measure from November 1914 onwards. What you'll see here is that Ruhleben was a race course, and that was deliberate in a sense that in Britain, for a brief period in 1914, Germans were interned at Newbury Race Course in Berkshire. I know that camp didn't last for very long, but Ruhleben lasted for 4 years. And the prisoners slept in horse boxes. They had access to the race course itself and to three grandstands. And the location was between the railway that goes out to Spandau and then to Hamburg and the River Spree. So who was interned here? Around 5,500 prisoners passed through it at any one time. Maximum number in February 15, 1915 was about 4,200. So there's quite a bit of turnover. Who were they? Around a third of them were Germans who happened to have British nationality and had kept it for various reasons. So they were often been brought up in Germany, sometimes referred to as Scheinengländer or Deutschfreundlich or even Deutschgesinnt prisoners. Many of them had wives and children living outside the camp in Berlin or in Hamburg in particular. And they often did not return back to Britain because they'd never been to Britain, because they were German and had acquired British nationality through marriage to a British person. Another third of the prisoners were sailors who were on board British registered ships in Hamburg in 1914. And so there's a big sailing community fraternity at Berlin. A third are Deutschengländer or German, essentially people who've been brought up in Germany, have German families, and just happened by chance to have British nationality. It was worth having British nationality before 1914 because you avoided peacetime conscription in the German army if you had a British passport or British documents. One third are sailors. The remaining third come from all kinds of different backgrounds. But we have tourists, we have academics, including Shakespeare experts. There's an important Shakespeare conference in Ruhleben in 1916, tercentenary for Shakespeare. Scientists, football coaches, the three main football teams in Berlin at that time were coached by British coaches. Criminals, there's quite a few people who were involved in the red light district in Hamburg and who were on the run from Scotland Yard, from the British police. And that's why they were in Germany. Journalists, of course, and various other groups. A fair number of them, several hundred of them, were so-called colonial Engländer from all over the British Empire and various parts of it. And I'm now going to hand over to Michelle Kiesling, who's going to tell us a story about parts of this, colonial
As part of a project at university, I was researching the family history of David Russell, who was a Black British inmate at Ruhleben. As Matt already said, in internment camps in Germany and Austria, there were also Black and Asian civilians who were interned because of their British or French nationality. And Ruhleben had over 100 Black British inmates. Among these were sailors who had initially been held on ships in Hamburg, and also civilians who had lived in Germany before the war, and in some cases had even started their families there. David Russell was one of the Black British inmates at Ruhleben, and I will tell you more about him. He was born in Jamaica in 1874 and went to sea around 1900. He eventually ended up in Austria after working for a traveling show. In 1905, he had settled in Leipzig, where he first worked at a cigar factory and later as a merchant. It was in Leipzig where he met Anna Peschel, a local woman whose father most likely worked at the same factory as they did. The two of them met and they fell in love and were married in 1908. Anna's father and her brother Bruno were present at their wedding. Through the marriage, Anna had lost her German citizenship and she became a British subject based on her husband's nationality. This meant that when David was arrested in 1914, as he was a British subject, she was left destitute as she couldn't get any welfare payments through the German government. David, Anna, and the children were also largely isolated from German society and also from Anna's family. This is evident through a lack of both parents on their children's baptism records. And also because when Anna had to travel to Britain, she was able to claim welfare benefits from local poor law guardians. Her family cut ties to her and they did not keep in touch with her. Anna and her children, who did not speak a word of English, traveled to Hull and arrived there in January 1915. They were placed in a workhouse there. Anna was separated from her children. Her children were sent to the seaside. This was as a means to prevent an overcrowding of the workhouse, while at the same time also attempting to provide better living conditions for children. At the same time, at Hoolleben, David and other Black prisoners of war were largely segregated from white inmates. They inhabited their own barracks, barrack number 13 and later also barrack 21. With some exceptions, they were largely excluded from the cultural activities at the camp, which led to further isolation in an already psychologically challenging environment. David was particularly affected as he was separated from his family and he feared for their well-being in Britain. He regularly inquired about their welfare through the American embassy and pleaded for his wife to be reunited with their children. Due to the cold and wet living conditions, which persisted in the initial years of the First World War at the camp, he had lost all his toes and he suffered from mental health problems. This was one of the reasons why he was repatriated to England in 1916. In Britain, he was reunited with his family and they had four more children and ultimately settled in Nottingham. Although David worked in various jobs, the family faced poverty, racial discrimination, and isolation. Some poor law officials in England tried to help them, while others showed open prejudice towards Anna for marrying a Black man. Already 2 years after the reunion, David and Anna wrote to the Colonial Office in London to request passage to Jamaica for their family. You may or may not be able to tell, it's written in German and it's also written by Anna. This is because David was most likely illiterate and assumed that Anna was most likely not confident enough to write such an important letter in English. In the letter, they mentioned the social isolation they faced by saying, "Meine Heimat ist Jamaika. Alle meine Geschwister und Verwandten leben eben da. Ich habe niemand in England," which translates to, "My home is in Jamaica. All my siblings and relatives live there. I have no one in England." Their plea was rejected. In autumn 1922, David walked all the way from Nottingham to London to once again request for his family's passage to Jamaica. That he made this long and excruciating journey despite his poor health conditions shows in which desperate situation the foreign family was. However, his plea was once again rejected, as the Colonial Office in Jamaica only allowed David to return, but not his family. In 1937, David left England without his family, and he returned to Jamaica, where he died in 1946. Anna, who had by then become a grandmother, died in Nottingham in 1965. Today, some of their descendants still live close to Nottingham, and they're trying to reconnect to their family history and their ties to Germany and Jamaica. David and Anna's stories is just one of many, and it shows the separation and trauma that many minorities faced during the 19th and 20th century. As part of my PhD project, in which I'm researching a Black presence in Austria from 1880 to 1945, I am also looking at Black prisoners of war in Austrian internment camps. So far, we found evidence of Black internees in the Austrian internment camps Katzenau, which was situated near Linz, and Drosendorf. Camp reports at Katzenau report unrest and jealousy towards British and French internees, as they received Red Cross provisions, while the Italian inmates did not. Some of the stories I've uncovered so far remind me of David and Anna's story, and I'm excited to see how much more we can uncover in the future.
one of the panels that you'll see downstairs is specifically on David Russell and that story. So one thing that we can learn from this is that there's clearly a psychological angle to internment, being held in internment indefinitely. Although internment had taken place before the First World War in various settings, most famously in the Boer War, perhaps in materially much worse circumstances, the length of time people were held, 4 years and more, was unprecedented. And not knowing when you're going to be released, when it's going to finish, was unprecedented as well. In terms of material conditions, particularly if we take Ruhleben as an example, the British prisoners in Ruhleben, the men of military age, were often better off than their wives and children living outside the camp, but in Berlin or Hamburg. Certainly by the second half of the war, whereas British prisoners in Germany were being fed quite regularly by Red Cross food parcels, which were not pilfered, because Germany wanted to protect the interests of its nationals throughout the British Empire. Those who were living on the outside, i.e. wives and children, found they had no access to charity, no access to German charities. They could only claim charity from Britain if they went back to Britain to face, as Michelle's shown us, to face the poor law, which wasn't exactly the most charitable of institutions itself. Anna Pershley is a rare example of somebody who went to Britain. Most of the wives and children stayed in Germany. And one of the key things, I found several documents illustrating this, when prisoners, wives and children visited their fathers, husbands in Ruhleben, they were allowed to do so twice a month, they smuggled food out of the camp, which is very different from our image, our conventional image of what prison camps are like, because there was Red Cross food parcels in the camp. When the camp was dissolved during the revolution, November 1918, the guards deposed the officers and raised the red flag in the middle of the camp. But they warned the prisoners, the people in Spandau, in to the west of Berlin, there's a rumor that there's a lot of food in this camp. Be careful, because obviously the Berlin people were very hungry at that time due to the British economic blockade. On the other hand, if we're going to say that material conditions were certainly not as bad as in some of the Second World War camps, and it was actually better to be in a camp than not be in a camp in many circumstances, the psychological injury of internment is something that I've been researching quite a lot, and particularly this figure, Adolf Lukas Vischer, a Swiss doctor who worked for the Swiss Red Cross and who wrote a book, first in German, Die Stacheldraht Krankheit, and then in English translation, Barbed Wire Disease, about the psychological impact of long-term internment on what he said were previously healthy minds and bodies. Vischer had already worked for the Red Cross as a field surgeon during the First Balkan War in 1912. He also went on several POW Red Cross missions, looking at POW camps, inspecting them, in Europe and in Asia Minor during the First World War. But in 1917, he was appointed to be head of the medical services at the Swiss legation in London. And through that, and through his contacts with the Quakers, another group alongside the Red Cross who were involved in humanitarian assistance to prisoners, through those, he managed to gain access to Nokelo, which Panikos has already mentioned, the big camp on the Isle of Man, and to stay there for four whole days. He'd actually visited twice before on a sort of day for a few hours, but he decided to live in the camp for 4 days. And what did he find? The conditions were first rate, as Red Cross reports had already shown. Britain was obeying the Hague Conventions and Geneva Conventions regarding treatment of prisoners of war. The medical facilities and the food conditions were at least adequate, if not good. And yet he found the prisoners deeply depressed. This was November 1917. He found that even though the conditions were very good, the mental state of the prisoners was very concerning to him, and that this wasn't being found by finding. The Red Cross reports are full of details about diet and medical facilities, but nothing about the depression that he saw by staying there for 4 days. He had already visited prisoners in neutral Switzerland. Sue's going to talk about neutral Switzerland after me, but he'd already seen in Switzerland, in some of the sanatoria, some of the best conditions, physical conditions for prisoners in Switzerland. They were held in neutral internment under various international agreements. And yet, even there, he'd found cases of deep depression. And so he published his book, The Stacheldrahtkrankheit, Barbed Wire Disease, in which he described the following list of symptoms. Episodes of, I'm deliberately using the word brain fog for reasons that will become apparent in a minute, but in French, he used the word blanc. Periods where you can't concentrate anymore, bad dreams, sleeplessness, irritability, restlessness, difficulties in concentrating, problems with memory, pessimistic outlook. This caused him to fall out in many ways with the Quakers and others because he said, it doesn't matter how many books you send in for prisoners to read or how much equipment material you give them to make toys for children. After 6 months of this, you lose the power of concentration. You lose the motivation to read. And many of the people in Nokelo were from educated backgrounds who would have read, active people, journalists, people who had active careers before their internment. And he found all of this. And he said, it doesn't really matter. The only real cure for barbed wire disease, the only way of mitigating it is to release all the prisoners. Sending in aid to the prisoners, giving them things to do, does not really help in the long run. More than that, in a shorter piece that he wrote in 1919, only in German, on the psychology of transition, he talked about how we don't know what the long-term impact of this will be. The men are released, but many of them have been, in his mind, destroyed psychologically by their experiences. In this shorter piece, an extract of which was published in a bigger compendium in Feindeshand. In Feindeshand is an Austrian compendium about First World War captivity published in the early 30s. Barbed wire disease, he describes as a psychological infection, which is interesting. So it's not a viral infection, but something that infected camp inmates. And he warned that his effects will worsen with the end of the war, that prisoners released will find it very difficult to make the transition time. Typically, sufferers are not those in whom mental illness was previously lain dormant, but the hitherto completely healthy. He found that the more severe cases were people who had been previously completely healthy in mind and body prior to internment. Most important of all, up until now, he said, nothing is known for certain about the prognosis of the disease. He didn't claim to know what would happen. He just said, we don't know what is going to happen to prisoners. We don't know what the long-term impact is, but we need to take it seriously. Fisher was criticized by humanitarian groups. He was, the English version has an introduction by S.A. Kinnear Wilson, who was a British-American neurologist. And it's not very praising of the book. In many ways, it's very critical and says that the evidence of for the uniqueness of the internment camp as opposed to criminal prison. He said that he didn't find that convincing. He didn't see, Kinnear Wilson did not agree with Fisher that the environment of the camp was unique. Fisher was very strong on this. He said it's the healthier elements that are vulnerable to barbed wire disease. He was very heavily criticized. He switched professions, really. He remained a medic, but he switched to gerontology in the 1920s. Perhaps, I haven't seen his papers, but perhaps because he was wounded by the criticism. Stacheldrahtkrankheit, barbed wire disease, rarely appears in the Second World War. It didn't quite take on like shell shock did as a term to describe mental impact of being a prisoner of war. In Germany, after the Second World War, the more usual term was Heimkehrerkrankheit, returnees sickness, which had many similar symptoms, but was not called Stacheldrahtkrankheit. So Fisher didn't really make a huge impact on the medical or the humanitarian communities involved, although he did have a bigger impact on prisoners who recognized the symptoms that we've been talking about and who recognized these symptoms in themselves even after release. And of course, I was already interested in this before COVID. I am not for a minute suggesting that lockdown is the same thing as being interned. It's not, for a whole variety of reasons. Nonetheless, not knowing how long such a thing is going to last and not knowing what the long-term consequences are for people who are in lockdown, and bearing in mind that some people were in lockdown in the UK for a lot longer because of their vulnerabilities, pre and post, I was interested in the fact that Fisher says we don't know what the long-term consequences are. And since then, I've become, obviously lockdown was a period that didn't last quite as long as the First World War, thankfully, but it has transitioned into, for some people, into long COVID. And we still don't really know what long COVID is. but I read a book by two. Gez Medinger is an advocate for sufferers of long COVID, and Danny Altman is an expert on long COVID, insofar as we can have experts so far, because we still don't fully understand it. But they talk about the emotional assault delivered by long COVID can be just as intense as the physical assault. Clearly, long COVID, unlike captivity, is caused by a virus, and that's the physical assault. But there may be parallels with the emotional assault of being subject to a lockdown that lasts a long time because of the consequences of the physical assault of COVID. Symptoms include crushing sense of disappointment, intense grief, feelings of loss, and difficulties with transition, which is what Fisher was talking about, from one state of the illness, having the virus, to another state of the illness, the virus having vanished, having negative COVID tests, but still feeling very different in yourself than you did before. So I end with this tantalizing question, which I'm still working on, and I'm not committing myself 100% to any definite statement about this, but did Vischer and World War I pave the way for understanding an extended wartime captivity as an emotional assault that lasts after captivity, in the same way as long COVID is experienced by sufferers of this, as an assault not just of a virus, but on their whole identity and their being? Long COVID has often also hit people who previously were completely healthy and very active in their lives and careers, and it's curtailed them in many ways. So that's my pitch on mental health and how it was understood in 1918 at the end of the First World War, and how it might relate to some of the issues that we are facing today. And I think I now hand over to Sue on Switzerland.
Thank you. My talk is going to be about internments in Switzerland during the First World War. And as you can see from the dates, it is the second part of the war and the immediate aftermath. The research came about because I normally study tourism, and I was particularly interested in winter sports tourism in Switzerland and the development and investment in hotels that had gone on in Switzerland in the Belle Epoque Edwardian years, which meant that a lot of hotels had borrowed a lot of money to expand and were considerably in debt. Most of the studies that we have in history generally, but particularly in tourism, look at studies up until 1914, and then they stop, and then it starts again in the 1920s. So I was interested in what happened in that period in between. And out of it came this book, which is Internment in Switzerland During the First World War. And as far as I know, that's one of the few publications in English on that subject. I don't really know many other people that work on that, even in Switzerland. I only know a couple. One of the things that happened in the First World War quickly as the armies moved forwards was the number of prisoners of war that were taken. Over the whole war, there were at least 9 million people that were in prison. And the problem was what to do with them all, especially those that were injured or needed medical care. As a neutral state, Switzerland couldn't ignore the war that was waging all around them. And so this image on this poster shows the idea of Switzerland as an island of peace with war raging all around. But there were fears in Switzerland that the country could become involved in the war, and they felt the need to defend their borders so that they could keep open supply routes and also stop the armies crossing into Switzerland to try and get round to the other side and possibly opening up new fronts in the war, which wasn't in the interests either of Switzerland especially, or those of the countries that were fighting. Another problem in Switzerland was partisanship, and that depended on the role of the media, because people got their news in the different language areas of Switzerland from the news agencies of the countries that were at war. So people that spoke German would get their sources from German news sources, and French from French speakers, and so on. And so there was a problem that they were worried about getting dragged into the war, and also partisanship within Switzerland itself. A lot of German-speaking Swiss politicians, for instance, had been educated in German universities. And when Kaiser Wilhelm II visited Switzerland just a couple of years before the war, he'd had a really big welcome. And so now we're looking at how did this come about? And we've already heard talks of the Geneva Convention. So Article 2 of the 1906 Convention raised the idea of bringing wounded and sick prisoners of war to a neutral state. And then 1907, the Hague Convention also talked about the idea of internment of prisoners of war. Gustav Ador of the International Committee of the Red Cross, who was also a Swiss politician, began discussions to bring the less seriously wounded to Switzerland. Negotiating agreements between the warring states was a new concept. Normally, countries at war don't negotiate together over what to do with the prisoners and so on. So it was a new thing diplomatically and logistically. How would it be done? Pope Benoit XV also intervened, and in principle, internment was agreed for the sick and the wounded prisoners of each side in the summer of 1915. In Switzerland itself, I mentioned the problems with hotels having been in debt, but with war, they lost their customers. People were not going to go on holiday, even though Switzerland was at peace, because they'd have to cross warring countries to get there. They did keep about half the number of tourists, but they were people that stayed for longer, health seekers mostly. And so the Swiss hotel industry began to lobby to be able to take some of the wounded prisoners that had been agreed would come to them to stay in their hotels. At first, the idea had been that they would create internment camps, but because of the lobbying by the hotel and tourism industry, it was decided that they would put them in hotels instead. And people would be there on their word of honour not to try and go home. For the Germans, because it's just one border to cross, that was logistically something which could have been possible. And so although there were very few people that did try to go home, it was usually Germans or French that tried to do so and not British. But I'll explain how that would come about first. The agreements were initially between French and Belgium and Germany for the first exchange, which happened in January 1916. And then later, there were agreements between Britain and Germany. And also that involved France, because any Germans who were imprisoned in Britain would have to cross France as well and the Channel to get to Switzerland. So it was a logistical problem as well, which caused delays often because of battle conditions, weather conditions and so on. The illustration here is sort of like somebody's ticket. So Swiss doctors visited prison camps in France and Germany to decide which prisoners were suitable to be interned. The first ones that went were those that were suffering from TB, because Switzerland had a good record of TB treatment and had sanatoria with specialist facilities. But then by the spring, they started to take people that were seriously wounded as well. And by seriously wounded, we're talking about prisoners, men that had become injured, but were not completely disabled. If you were completely incapacitated and no longer able to play any role in the war, you could be repatriated and sent home. But there was a problem with people who might recover sufficiently to be able to do another job, which could release another person to be able to go and fight. The conditions to become an internment centre were put there. They had to have the capacity to house large numbers of internees, appropriate infrastructure, so physicians, pharmacies, workplaces, leisure facilities, administration structures to coordinate internment, and a way of adequately supervising the internees. And also, they had to be dependent on tourism, and that was because of the hotel lobby's efforts. Davos, as a specialist treatment centre, was where the first German TB patients arrived on the 26th of January 1916. Germany already owned sanatoria in Davos, which were owned by the German state, and so it was relatively simple for that to arrange. The way the internees were funded was the Swiss paid for their care, but it was reimbursed by their national states. So it involved diplomacy and agreements between the different belligerent countries. But one of the agreements was all of them had to be treated in exactly the same way. And when the prisoners arrived for their internment, they were warmly welcomed. They were given gifts, chocolate, cigarettes, and crowds would come out to greet them. There would be celebrations and they'd be made very welcome. So you can see in the picture the crowds and some of the flowers. And we can also see that those that came, the British prisoners moving from Germany, includes troops from the different British colonies. So you can see some Indian troops and so on there. How do I know what happened in the internment camps? Well, the internees in all of the camps produced their own magazines. And I think that was a common feature of prison camps generally. But the Germans in Switzerland produced a magazine called the Deutsche Internierten-Zeitung, which was edited by Hermann Hesse. These are important sources of information about the daily lives and the preoccupations of the internees. One way that the German magazine differs slightly from the French, Belgian, and British magazines was that there seems to be less reports of sport and leisure activities in it. But what information I did get would be about marriages, births, deaths, and information which would be useful to the internees, such as what was going on in different communities in Switzerland. They weren't allowed to have news from home in it, by the way. So they were very much isolated in there. The internees were not in a single sex environment so that they were able to have their families visit. They could meet local Swiss women who could get married and their girlfriends could visit them. And in the leisure time, they were free to do more or less what they liked as long as they fitted a strict routine. To encourage them to rehabilitate, there was education, training, and they could go to work to earn extra money towards going out and so on. Because boredom, as we saw in the other internment in Britain, in the colonies and in Ruhleben, was a problem. And so the preoccupations were very, very similar for all those groups, which is quite interesting. Although in Switzerland, they weren't prisoners. They were free to go out. There was no barbed wire. They still had those same problems of the barbed wire disease, as Matthew has talked about. Sport was also important for physical recreation, and hotels had great facilities for sport and leisure, which was a good thing for them in Switzerland. So I'm going to finish there and then answer other issues on any questions. Altogether, 67,000 prisoners were interned in Switzerland, which is a very small percentage, almost minute compared to the 9 million that were interned altogether. And so I think it was a very, very lucky position for people to experience after they'd already been 2 years in a prison camp. So they did feel very, very privileged to be able to have this experience. Thank you.
First of all, apologies from Marina Marcos de Perez, who unfortunately feels unwell and apologizes for not being able to give a presentation today. However, she wrote one of the panels, which you can see on the ground floor, so she does have an input in this conference. Before I start, I'd just like to express a warm thanks to Professor von Hodenberg for letting us present our research here, not just through the papers which you've just heard, but also through the exhibition downstairs, which we will see later on today, and also the virtual reality. So what you've just heard is an incredibly rich story around the First World War, which hasn't really come to light yet. It's been described by historians, especially over the last 10, 15 years, but it hasn't really made its way into the general public. And this is something I'd like to talk about a little bit. How do we actually translate all these incredibly interesting stories into a piece of public history that is understood by the general public? And I'm doing this together with Paul Long, who has been working together with me. Paul Long will speak after me, the creative director of MBD. That's a company based in Leicester. We've just been collaborating together on a project, South Africa, World War I, and this is something you'll see the virtual reality about later on. So the exhibition you see has come out of one of two AHRC-funded projects, the first one on civilian internment in the First World War. So you might have seen some of the panels already. This is the Behind the Wire logo. And the exhibition was initially launched in Hoyt Museum in Scotland. And see the exhibition launch here on Armistice Day 2018. So it's basically the exhibition you see downstairs. It's been complemented in the meantime with a couple of panels from colleagues who've been giving papers today as well. So downstairs is a modified version. By Hoek, the main camp in mainland, so Knockhalo was the biggest camp in the British Empire, actually, but the biggest camp in mainland Britain was Storps near Hoek. Hoek has got a lovely museum, a Victorian museum, and it also has an archive. So the geographical reference point for the project is Hoek with the museum and the archive, which has now an internment research center, again, all gratefully funded by the AHRC, with resources, original resources, and also a number of books on the topic of internment. The exhibition is a traveling exhibition, which has been shown in countries around the world, and especially in locations where actually internment camps existed. So it's a perfect way of communicating to local publics their connection with the global theaters of war. So what happened locally also happened on a global scale. Just three examples here. One is KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. This is where the Fort Napier camp, which was mentioned earlier, was located just outside Pietermaritzburg. And the exhibition panels here, and then complemented with some local artifacts, such as toys or wooden objects produced by the internees in these glass cases. Another example is a museum in, or a gallery in Canada, where there were a lot of camps as well. And there was the exhibition on walls here, but also the local exhibitors complemented this with a piece of barbed wire from the local camp. Again, in order to bring the global story home to local audiences. The last example is Barbados Museum, where it was just shown last year in an old colonial prison. This was not the one where the internees were actually held. That was in a more modern Victorian prison. But anyway, the prison environment replicates that situation for the internees. And just as here and in all the other ones, specific panels were written for that specific location on that respective camp. So it's just to give you a couple of ideas what you can actually do with that story, how you can communicate this to others. So that was the first project. And then there came a follow-on project entitled South Africa World War I, which has a number of digital outputs, so a combination of analog and digital outputs. This was launched on Armistice Day in November last year in KwaZulu-Natal Museum. It contains two virtual reality experiences, an heritage app, and several education resources. So this is now briefly talking about the virtual reality. This is based on basically one chapter of the book, which I published together with Panikos. It translates that into virtual reality. And as you will have the opportunity to watch it later, you might want to watch out for some of the research paradigms which have already been mentioned. So this is a direct translation of research into virtual reality. One is, for example, the role of women, not in camps, but women were just as affected as men by internment because the breadwinner was gone and many women fell into destitution. So this is, in a creative way, built into that virtual reality experience through a correspondence between an interned man and his wife outside the camp and their children. So this is a correspondence which I found in the archives and which I then created or recreated for that virtual reality experience. Other research paradigms are the globality of internment. This is a picture of KwaZulu-Natal Museum. This is basically what happens there at this very moment. The virtual reality experience and the exhibition are now part of the permanent exhibitions. And it's something you will be able to experience later today as well as we, after this, go downstairs and look at the exhibition and the virtual reality experiences. I think I'll hand over to Paul, who will say a few words generally.
Good evening. My name is Paul Long, and I am creative director of MBD. I am neither an academic historian, nor am I particularly an expert in internment, which begs the very reasonable question, what on earth am I doing here? And I have a very strict 5 minutes to answer that question. I think the short version is, like, what I am interested in is broadening the discussion about historical research and the kind of stories that we're uncovering here into creative outputs like the exhibition that Stefan has made and the virtual reality project that we did together. So I am creative director of MBD, as I said, and MBD is a virtual reality and immersive media storytelling organization. And a lot of our projects are led by research, and they focus in particular a lot of the time on historical stories. Our work's been shown at festivals on multiple continents and online to more than 150,000 people. And we collaborated last year with Stefan and with Aston University to make a VR project around South Africa's involvement in World War I, including an episode on internment, which for most of you, obviously, is the point of interest today. Our work is all generated in games engines. So it's the same kind of technology as would be used for console games like PlayStation and Xbox. But we've used it for creating live events, online projects, and bringing to life research projects like this. So behind me, you'll just see a rolling gallery of images from our recent work. And you'll see the broad range of applications that we found for 3D live render content, from outdoor shows to heritage films to virtual reality, like the one that you're going to see downstairs. And what I'm interested in is how we can start to redefine ways we can bring research to life and to start to experience stories, and particularly historical stories, in a new and an immersive way. So VR is often referred to as an empathy machine because it is a complete immersion of the visual and oral senses. And VR can be very convincing in terms of making us feel like we are in a different place or experiencing a different story from somebody else's point of view, or even from a different point in time. And as there is now increased focus on ways of sharing research in ways that are relevant to the wider public, creating stories that are readily accessible through technology is an increasingly compelling solution. So as a company, MBD is 25 years old. Now, for obvious reasons, we didn't start off in VR. But for over 20 years, we've based our creative storytelling in historical research. And sometimes that has been with academic partners, other times with museums or galleries, and often with historical sites as well. And one of the things that we noticed very quickly is that the way that we approached these historical stories was to hone in on the experience of people, as opposed to the facts, figures, dates approach, which is how I was taught history at school. And what was it like to live there, for example, with us? How did it feel? What were the interests of those people? And what was the world like that surrounded this house, this cathedral, this castle, this workplace? And it's my belief that people connect more readily with stories of other people than they do with those facts and statistics. And if we understand what links us together, we can better understand each other's stories across time and across cultures and between places. And that's not exclusive to virtual reality or to the heritage sector, for that matter. It's an ethos that we've applied to all of our research-led work then and now. But VR does open up new possibilities. And so I will just touch briefly on the experience of making South Africa World War I and the collaboration that we had with Stefan. So South Africa World War I was designed to reframe remembrance, to be more inclusive. And we've also previously worked with research partners on similar films around Caribbean and South Asian troops' involvement in World War I, as well as issues of modern migration linked to the story of the Mayflower sailing in 1620. And needless to say, the sensitivities behind all of these subjects mean that the relationship between research and creative process needs to be built on trust from day one. And a diverse team is essential to offer input and reflection at all stages of that process. South Africa World War I was no different. South Africa is a union built on a history of division. And thankfully, this history was something that we could be guided through by Stefan and the team that he assembled. But that team itself was diverse in terms of our own disciplines and the way we treat this material. We didn't start off with a shared language or shared reference points. For academics and historians who are accustomed to using maybe tens and thousands of words, tens of thousands of words to adequately cover their subject, turning that into a 15-minute combination of prose and poetry with a strict time limit is no easy task. And also, VR has its own workflow. It's complicated and it's new, so no one's really settled on the best way to make it. But for the purposes of a linear experience like you're going to watch, it's easy to think of it like a traditional film. So the creative process is broadly script, storyboard, production. In shorthand, then, the first task is to get a reasonably comprehensive understanding of a subject that in some cases has been somebody's life's work. And from thousands of pages taken from a variety of sources, we distill those main themes and write a narrative that conveys the emotional and contextual information that's needed. That's passed back and forth between different partners and stakeholders until the few words that make the final cut have the greatest impact. When we get to storyboarding, those words are accompanied by pictures, old photographs, modern reference, maps, written descriptions. And then we'll fill in any remaining gaps and agree on a handful of reference drawings that put us where we need to be. And again, that might sound simple, but even though I suggest using a classic film workflow to understand how VR is made. VR doesn't work like film. So in the production phase, everything that we've decided we need is built from scratch in 3D. If we need a ship, we have to model a ship. A diamond mine, the same applies. We model buildings, street furniture, the sea, and the land. We decide the time of day and the lighting, but we have to build it all. And that takes time too. I could talk about this all at great length, but I am on a time limit. Okay, so the important thing to understand is that while we have the experience to know how the piece works technically and creatively, our partners usually do not have the same creative experience. But while we come away with a decent understanding of the story we're telling, our partners do know in great detail so much more about that subject. In short, we need each other. That trust is key. And since we began working in immersive media, we've explored the stories of Caribbean and South Asian troops in World War I, the voyage of the Mayflower, the moon landing of 1969, the gunpowder plot of 1606, and we've preserved a present-day audio and photo archive from UK graffiti artists that can be accessed across the world. This and so many projects across our history prove time and again that we can learn so much from our shared history. And almost every event we are currently experiencing has a historical parallel, whether it's wars, civil unrest, cultural clashes, political reform, or simply how we choose to have fun. I think by understanding our past, we can help to imagine a better future. So let me just summarize very briefly how we kind of fit in with that research and academic community, what our skills bring in terms of added value. For me, the key thing is that public outcomes are important, whatever form they take. Research cannot and should not live in silos in academic institutions. If the research a university is doing is important, then it is also really important that we share that research in some way. It helps people to understand more about our work, about what I do, about what you do. It helps them to understand about themselves and their history and the wider world that surrounds them. And creative outputs do this in a relatable and an authentic way. We're not just dealing with abstract facts, but with how they shape lives, with the emotional and cultural impacts of the events we're talking about. And creative outputs tap into the emotional responses of people involved in those stories as well, and the audiences who watch them. So for me, technology, and in particular VR, creates a gateway to really immerse people in the worlds that we make. Be that a place in history like South Africa in World War I, or a view of a world that we can't really inhabit, like living in a painting or visualizing music to create better accessibility, or seeing the world through the eyes of another person. VR shouldn't be seen as a threat to traditional research or to museums and heritage spaces. Instead, it's simply a new tool to reach people and experience history in new and interactive ways. At its best, it connects people to research in a relatable and immersive way. And it opens the door not just to learn, but for more people to feel, to experience, and to empathize with the experiences of people and stories from our past. Thank you.
Thanks very much to all the speakers.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.